We've traveled to beautiful downtown Burbank in California to talk to a fellow who made a very important impact on Chicago not too many years ago. Greg Garrison, you had a pretty good time working with some early Chicago television things, didn't you?
Oh, my goodness. That's early. Early is like 1947, 48, 49. That's when I was in Chicago working in television at a station that... I think they changed the call letters. When I was there, it was called WENR, and it was the ABC affiliate in Chicago, and it was at the Opera House.
And you were directing Mary Hartline and Claude Kirshner and some of the others in the Super Circus scene? Producing
as
it?
No, I was a director in those days. As a matter of fact, when I was working in Chicago, we were... If you weren't directing at least 12 to 14 shows a week, you really weren't earning the $120 a week you were getting, you know. And that's what I did. I had like three or four strip shows, Uncle Mistletoe, some of the older Chicagoans remember that, and Super Circus, and a series we started that opened up the cable from Chicago to New York called Stand By for Crime with Mike Wallace. It was the first job that Mike ever had as in television.
In TV,
And Mike and I go back a long way. As a matter of fact, he's one of my big heroes. And while I was going to Northwestern, I got a job as a copy boy for a radio station that went on the air just before the war called...
WNMP.
No, that's not what it was. No, is that your station?
That was a station that we were involved.
No, this was called, this was at the station at the top of the Chicago Daily News building, and the head announcer was, it was a news station, and it was news 24 hours a day, every hour on the half hour, and I forgot the call letters, but Clifton Utley, the father of Garrick Utley, was the news analyst, and Mike Wallace was one of the announcers on the staff. And there were some others there that later went on and became executive and editorial people with Life and Time and Fortune. But Mike was my hero. And anything he said, once he said, gee, you ought to get your hair cut. And I went, yes, sir. And I went downstairs in an elevator. And as you know, is it still on West Madison, 400 West Madison, the Chicago Daily News?
No, they've got a brand new building.
Okay,
now.
Well, in those days, it was 400 West Madison Street, and it was a pretty rough neighborhood. This is 30 years, I guess, or so ago. And the nearest barbershop was a barber school. And I walked in and I said, give me a haircut quick. And they just went zzzz. And I came back upstairs and he said, my God, what happened to you? And I said, you told me to get a haircut. And he said, you got a haircut because I told you? And I said, sure. And he said, just because I told you? And I said, yes. He said, oh. And he realized that he was stuck with somebody that was a hero worshiper.
He was Myron Wallace then, too, wasn't he?
We called him Mike, We always called him Mike. Myron, yeah. As a matter of fact, he referred to himself in those days as Myron Wallace.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was a staff man at NBC for a long time.
Yeah, I guess he was. And then later he freelanced all over town. And then we wrote a little bit during the war to one another. And then I was shot down in a airplane during the war and ended up in a prison camp, and someplace along the way everybody was told that I was gone, it was over, and they, you know, I took a cab. And after the war I came back to Chicago, and I started in television in Philadelphia before I got to Chicago.
Well, how did you get from Philadelphia to Chicago in TV? Now, this is
after the war,
after
the war, I went back to school, and I went to a school called Lafayette College in eastern Pennsylvania. Then I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and I graduated, and I got a job as a second assistant stage manager at a Broadway show in New York called Harvey. And a second assistant stage manager is not too far removed from, hey, boy, get me a sandwich, you know, or open up the door, and I'd say, yes, sir. And the stage manager was a brilliant. Now he's a professor and he runs the University of Southern California Drama School, and a great director by the name of Alex Siegel. He was the stage manager, and he said to me one day, he said, we're going to Philadelphia. I said, what are we going to do? And he said, we're working in television. And I said, what the hell is that? This was 47, early 47. And he said, He said, don't worry about it. We're going to teach you something, and we're getting out of Broadway, and we're going to start in Philadelphia in television. And I said, terrific. And I said, what are they going to pay me? And he said, I don't know, but they're paying me $60 a week. I said, well, if they're paying you $60, what am I going to get? And he said, I don't know. How about $35? And I said, oh, God, well, okay. So we got to Philadelphia, and I started answering the telephones at the switchboard and cleaning out waste paper baskets. That was the first day. The second day, I was pushing a dolly. The third day, the cameraman became a director, so I was the cameraman. The fourth day, the audio man became a producer, so I became the audio man. And by the end of 8 days, I was directing, and that's how fast things happened in those days. I stayed there about a year, and then moved on to Chicago. I'd stayed in Chicago 2 years, and two men used to come out from New York on weekends, and they would watch what they like to refer to as the early periods of Chicago School of Television. And they would come around to studios, and they would sit, and one was Fred Allen. And he would occasionally take us to lunch. He would come out mm-hmm. on a Friday night and stay Saturday and Sunday. And the other one was a man by the name of Max Liebman. And I didn't really know who Max Liebman really was. But he was really a nice man. And Fred Allen, of course, you know, and we all just felt that Fred Allen was king, you know.
He was coming out just watch the TV scene there?
Uh-huh. The TV scene in Chicago. Mm-hmm. That was his... that he'd come and he'd sit and he'd watch and he'd stay, he'd ask a couple of questions. You couldn't find a nicer, warmer, mm-hmm. kinder, sweeter, more really gentle human being, you know, than Fred Allen. He was. As a matter of fact, the last time I remember crying was when I read in the newspaper many years ago that he died on the streets of New York. Mm-hmm. He was a superhuman being. And he would come out, and Max Liebman would come out, and they would talk to us and everything else. And we felt, you know, so flattered. These two important, you know, well, not Max hadn't really achieved much in television, nothing, as a matter of fact. But we all knew mm-hmm. about Fred Allen. And anyway, one day I got a call from somebody who said, "Hey, I'm the president of NBC in New York, and we want you to come to New York, and we have a show that we think you would be very good on." And I said, "Oh, terrific!" And he said, "When can you be here?" And I said, I don't know, what do you want me? He said, how about tomorrow afternoon and we have lunch? And I went, to lunch? You mean I got to wear a tie and a jacket and all? Because a lunch to us was a hamburger. You know, you grab a hamburger and you go and you direct seven more shows that afternoon. We never had time for lunch. So I went to New York and I met him, and his name was Pat Weaver. He was the president of NBC. He was a dynamo. He was a terrific fellow and responsible for so much in this industry as a major executive. And he said, "Have you ever heard of a fellow called Sid Caesar?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, there's a man called Sid Caesar and a producer who's done a lot of shows up in the, you know, in the Borscht Belt and throughout the country by the name of Max Liebman. And there's a comedian who's terrific by the name of Imogene Coca. And then we found a couple of young dance teams, one called, the girl's name was Marge. And the guy's name is, I'm not sure he said of the, but the last name is Champion." He said, "Oh, that's it. Marge and Gower Champion and Max Liebman and Sid Caesar and Imogene Coco. And we've got some new young writers." Turned out that one of those new young writers was Mel Brooks. And the other new young writer, one of the other new young writers, was Doc Simon, who did pretty well later on. So I said, "Okay, fine, where do I go?" And then they sent me over to this big office building, and I walked in, and I saw this man walking around who looked vaguely familiar, who I'd seen out in Chicago. And I thought he was, you know, at the time, I thought he was Fred Allen's driver or, you know, companion who took care of his bags or something. And I walked around, and he said hi, and he smiled, and he started showing me around. And I said, "Gee," I said, you know, it's like an old sketch. I said, "Tell me about this Max Liebman fellow, you know." So he said, "Oh, you'll like him, and don't worry, he'll like you, and you'll get along fine." And, of course, you know the end of the story. He was, of course, Max Liebman. So they brought me to New York, and I started to direct a show that became quite popular in those days, and I guess a lot of people still remember it, called The Show of Shows. And I stayed with Max for about 2.5 years.
And you were in on the very beginning of The Show of Shows, huh?
As a matter of fact, we're working on an NBC 50th anniversary show right now that's going to air November the 21st. And it's marvelous because I will suddenly, walk into one of the screening rooms with some of the youngsters that we have here that are screening material, and I will go, hold it, just a second, wait, just stop it for a second. And they would look, and they say, why? And I say, I think I did this show 26 years ago. I'm not, yeah, I did this. And they would say, like, okay, so what? I said, well, okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You know, go ahead, go do it. But it's been great fun for me to sit back and look at some of the shows that we did. Anyway, the rest is just a series of events and a lot of lucky breaks and moving around in an industry that I've been in all my life. And I went from there and I worked with Burl and with Kate Smith, and then I came.
Oh, okay. Now we're going to back up a minute.
Okay.
Now, you can't just write off 25 or more years of television and your contribution to it in a couple of sentences. Now, we want to start with the show of shows, and we'll walk through this a little bit if you've got a couple of minutes. You did the show of shows, a 90-minute, really a special, but
right.
It was a series,
90 minutes, right.
Live,
right.
Every week.
Well, let me tell you how it really worked. I came to New York to do the show of shows, and they brought me there in August. And there was a powerful, dynamic producer in New York by the name of Ted Collins, who was Kate Smith's producer manager.
Mm-hmm.
And he heard, you know how stories start, and he heard about some 14-year-old boy or whatever I was at the time, that they brought from Chicago to do this big hour-and-a-half extravaganza. And he really never even met me. He didn't know anything about me. But he decided he wanted that kid to direct a Kate Smith show. And he was a pretty powerful fella. He was a dynamic, powerful fella with a background of having Kate Smith on the radio for God knows how many years and being mm-hmm. tremendously successful, and had just sold NBC on the idea of doing a 5-day-a-week, hour-a-day Kate Smith show, which had never, ever been done on television before. 5 days a week, an hour a day. And he decided that he wanted this hot shot that they brought in, even though he never met him. And, of course, he got to the point where it became a thing. He really had to have this fellow. And I was very lucky, because I was that fellow. So what happened was, I directed the Kate Smith show 5 days a week. At 8 o'clock in the morning, we would come in, and the show would go on the air at 4 every afternoon and be over at 5. At 5 o'clock, I would jump in a cab. I was at the Hudson Theater on West 44th Street in New York. I would jump in a cab, and I would go to 56th Street, and they would arrange the rehearsals from 5:30 to 9 every night on the show of shows. And I would rehearse the show of shows from 5:30 to 9. Then I would go downstairs and get on a bicycle, and I would take a bicycle back up to 86th Street, where I had an apartment with my wife and kids. And then the following day, I would drive my bicycle downtown, leave it at 56th Street, take a cab to the Hudson Theater. It was terrific driving a bicycle around New York in those days. And weekends, I would do the show of shows. And it was live on Saturday from 9 to 10:30. And that's the way we did it.
That was quite a schedule for you.
I didn't know any better, and it didn't bother me, and I wasn't nervous, and I didn't think I needed more time or more rehearsal or more anything. We just knew that there was no such thing as videotape, and we mm-hmm. hardly knew about things called kinescopes, so those are just pieces of film that they did someplace in some funny little room up at NBC that they sent to California because they hadn't put a cable mm-hmm. in or something. And the truth of the matter is, I don't ever remember seeing a kinescope for maybe 5 or 7, 8 years after they were going, because we were just too busy doing the shows. Didn't know about kinescopes, you know.
What kind of problems did you run into with doing this live television? You know, today everything is on tape and they can cut out anything they want or piece it together or do it later, but you had to do it almost in one, so to speak.
We did. We did.
What kind of problems did you have with that?
We really didn't have any problems. We just didn't know any other way to do it, so we just went and did it. You know, it was, we just did it. I mean, I must tell you, today, if I would have to go into a studio and to do a live show, I think it might terrify me for a while. Say, God, what the cameras are going to break, the script, the actor will read, or what are we going to do, you know? Mm-hmm. But then you just did it. It just the adrenaline worked for all of us, the cameraman, the crew, the stagehands, the actors, the directors, all of us, the conductor. I mean, I remember moments through the years when we were, the sketch would run a little longer and we'd have to pick up maybe 15, 18, 20, 30, 40 seconds in musical numbers. It's true, I swear to you. There's a conductor. We have a group of girls now called the Gold Diggers. The conductor of the original show of shows was a man by the name of Charlie Sanford. He still works for us. Mm-hmm. He conducts the Gold Diggers, the act now, see. And Charlie had a clock, you know, implanted, a stopwatch implanted in some place in his brain. Mm-hmm. And if you said to Charlie in the middle of a three-minute number, could you give us 20 seconds? Could you give us 30 seconds? Charlie and that little clock would go to work, and he would pick up 20 or 30 seconds in a three-minute number. Now, that may not sound like a lot of time to those of you who are listening who are not musically inclined, but tempo-wise, and you can really throw an artist for a loop, but I must say that none of the artists were ever aware of anything that Charlie ever did. It was just something that went on between an on-the-air control room and an AD, who was my assistant director. And my assistant director in those days was a girl by the name of Pat Kennedy.
Pat Kennedy?
That's right. She was my assistant for about 4 years. She later married Peter Lawford. And
so the story goes.
That's it, yeah.
How did you move from Kate Smith then to Milton Berle? Or was that
That was kind of interesting because, getting back to Ted Collins, how do we get to... We got to Milton Berle by way of third base and Ted Collins. Milton wanted Kate to make a guest appearance on his show. Milton was the king of Tuesday night and really the king of television in those days. And he went to Ted and he said, okay, fine. He said, but on one condition, he said, my director directs the segment. And Milton said, wah, bah, bah, bah. He said, you want her? That's it. Yes or no? And Milton said, oh, sure, of course. No problem. Just go ahead and do it. So Ted said to me, he said, just go, and he said, direct the segment with Kate. So I only knew one thing. I had blinkers on. Ted said, go and do it this way. And I went, fine. That's the way I have to go and do it. So I went to the Milton Berle rehearsal. And Milton had his whistle on and his towel wrapped around his neck and was terrifying everyone. And I was really just too dumb to be afraid of Milton those days. And came time for Kate's number. And he said, so-and-so. And Kate went, excuse me, Mr. She always called him. She said, excuse me, Mr. Berle. She would say, and of course she knew him well, but she would say, excuse me, Mr. Berle, but my director is going to direct this sequence. And there was just a moment there, and Milton looked at Kate and went, oh, sure, Kate, sure, Catherine, anything you want, sure, anything, okay, fine. And he went mumbling off, and I went, okay, we're going to do this, and this. And I said, Milton, and I snapped my fingers at him, and nobody ever snapped their fingers at Milton because Milton was the king of finger snappers. And I used to come to work. I used to ride my bicycle with a baseball hat. And it got to, after a while, I used to wear the baseball hat. See, the baseball hat said Chicago Cubs, you see. And he would say, get the kid with the baseball hat. You know, what is he trying to do? And he went through a whole thing, and I wasn't afraid of Milton because, as I said, I didn't know any better. And we went ahead and we did the show, and that's the end of the story. And about a month later, Milton came on and did a reciprocal trade-off with Kate. And we didn't have anybody, you know, that ran the show the way Milton ran the show. The director ran the show, and Milton didn't, you know, wasn't aware that directors could really function on their own. He just felt that everybody had to be completely and 100% dependent upon Milton's whims. And... I just ran it the way we normally ran the show. And Milton kept saying, my God, I didn't know that, you know, look at this, and the kid. And he kept referring me as the fresh kid with the baseball hat. And the following year, he called me and he said, I'd like you to direct my show. And I said, terrific. So Milk's show was on Tuesday. And I left the show of shows and went to work for Burl. And I worked for Kate 4 days a week, and Milton I worked for on Tuesday, and this gave me my weekends off, you see. So it was big time.
Was this with the Texaco Theater?
This was the last year of the Texaco Star Theater and the first year of what they called the Buick Burl Show. Mm-hmm. I worked for Milton for 2 years. It was the start of what we called the Goody Ace period of Milton's life. We hired Goodman Ace and a staff of writers to write a book show for Milton. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty successful, I must say. It was very successful. I stayed with Milton for 2 years, and then I left and came to California. And nobody ever left Milton. You only got fired. And when I came to California, I said goodbye to Milton, and he walked out of the room, and somebody said, "How's Greg?" And he had his hat on. He took off his hat, put it on his heart, and he said, "He's not with me anymore." And the guy said, "My God, what happened?" And he said, "He went to California."
And then a whole new phase in Greg Garrison's life began out here.
Well, out here, I really started, and I decided I wanted to do some specials, and take it a little easier, getting away from the weekly series. So I started working on a series of specials, some at NBC, most of those at CBS, on something years ago called The Shower of Stars, and then I did a whole series for NBC the following year, probably, I think they called it the Ford Star Time. And I did some with Gene Kelly, and then I did an Astaire special, and we won all sorts of awards for some of those things. And eventually I ended up meeting the kid, and I refer to Dean as the kid.
Dean Martin.
Right, and that was about 14-15 years ago, and we have been together ever since. I started off as a director on his show, and there was another producer, and he was not terribly happy after the first four or five shows, and I eventually ended up producing and directing the show, and after, I don't know, a year or two, I started becoming a partial owner, and until eventually I became his partner. We have been together 15 years. We have never had a piece of paper. There has never been a contract. Mm-hmm. And Dean has just relied completely on, me and or my judgment to, put the shows on and get them done.
And you've done all the regular Dean Martin variety shows and the roasts and specials or whatever it was. Now you're totally wrapped up in a fantastic special that's coming up on NBC on the 21st of November, you mentioned earlier. It's a history, really, of the National Broadcasting Company, isn't it?
It's a history of our times as seen through the eyes of the National Broadcasting. It's really a company. It's an event of our times. It's really the first 50 years of broadcasting as we all know it, both in, radio and television. We're starting with, partially of a recreation of and some, transcriptions of the original broadcast of 26. Now, please keep in mind, that we are not going to be listening to little clips of radio for at least two of the 4 hours. Radio will be well represented, but we are using some clips, some old news footage, to tie together with some voices of radio. So you're not going to be looking at still pictures of performers that were around in those days. On the other hand, we have been tremendously fortunate, because of a lot of the publicity that we have been getting on the show, that private collectors throughout the world, and it's incredible. I mean, we have pieces of film and tape and kinescopes from collectors from the an American collector that's working at the American embassy in Moscow, somebody from China, somebody from, I mean, it's incredible. Taiwan, we've found stuff in Rio de Janeiro. We found stuff in Mexico City. You know, I mean, a collector doesn't have to live in Chicago or New York. Right, he can travel and go any place he likes, and he can stay there.
Well, you found these collectors in an ingenious way, didn't you?
Well, we put some ads in the trade papers, and we said, hey, help, we need some help. And I must say, it really worked, and we got a tremendous amount of the material there. And there were a couple of tapes, for example, that I really desperately needed. One that was a Gene Kelly show. We couldn't find the tape. There was no way. We put ads in the paper. We called people. I went through Gene's collection. I went through his house. I went to the attic. I talked to all the secretaries that worked for Gene Kelly through the year. Couldn't find it. And I was livid, absolutely livid, because there were about three things in this particular show that we really wanted to be part of this. And I raise Andalusian horses. That's my real thing in the world today. I really enjoyed it. I'm probably the biggest breeder of pure Andalusian horses in the United States. And I was out at the ranch one day, and we were moving some stuff out of a barn and getting rid of some old hay and putting in some alfalfa hay. And there in the corner in an old little ex-army jeep that I had was sitting a can. And in this can was the videotape that is 17 years old that I had in my house, in my garage, that I have been looking all over the world for, and I sheepishly brought it in the following morning, and I said, would you believe that I found this in my garage, and I almost had to turn my head away from everybody. And that's how you find things. You know, I mean, the really classic pieces that we find, people are really not aware that they have them. For example, this morning, a man called, and he said, I am the only male heir to the Olson and Johnson estate. Now, I must tell you, I'd like a dollar for every one of those phone calls that I got that turned out to be, you know, a little somebody that was just trying to have some fun at our expense. Turned out that this man was indeed exactly who he said. And he brought in six kinescopes from his mother, who lives in Las Vegas, right, of 1948 and 49 Olson and Johnson specials that we could not find anyplace else.
That's sensational. That's great.
Now, are we going to use them? Well, hopefully we'll find a moment or two in there that, you know, to use. His mother, for those of you with long memories, was June Johnson, who was married to the straight man in the Olson and Johnson.
Marty May.
Uh-huh. So it's June Johnson May, and the son is Billy May. And I don't know how.
Another Billy May.
Right, of course, his name would have to be May, right. Yeah. Right. That's who it was.
It's wonderful to find these things, and people who have some of that material, they don't even know that anybody's interested in it until, for one reason or another, they hear of something like this.
Well, that's true. That's true. On the other hand, there are a few performers who are really overly protective about what they considered to be performances that they were not overly thrilled with, or features that may have changed through the years that they are not overly excited about seeing. But by and large, there are just a handful of those. You know, I have no secrets. There's a piece of. There's a show called Petrified Forest. Now, originally it was done on Broadway, Maxwell Anderson. It was later made into a picture with Humphrey Bogart. Bogart did it on Broadway originally, by the way, with Humphrey Bogart and Leslie Howard, and I believe Betty Davis. And a few years after that, it was then remade into a television special in 1949 or 50. Once again, starring Humphrey Bogart, but this time with Lauren Bacall and Henry Fonda. It is, to the best of our knowledge, the only professional appearance by Humphrey Bogart on television. And we are trying desperately to get, and the only copy available is with Lauren Bacall. And we are trying desperately to get permission to use a moment from that clip. And hopefully, by the time the show goes on the air, we will have it. And if we don't have it, it's because the lady decided, for whatever her personal or professional reasons are, that she didn't want to give it to us. I don't want to sound like we're putting her in a spot, but that's pretty much what we're doing, really.
It would be sensational to see it, though.
It would be. It would be. It would be. We haven't even, you know, had a chance to screen it. We haven't had a chance to screen it. A lot of the old material that we remember, for example, let's talk about, we talked about the Shoah shows a few minutes ago. I remember sketches that I say, wait a minute, this is a terrific idea. Let's get that sketch, the This Is Your Life sketch. Let's go get it. That was a great sketch. And we went ahead and we got the sketch and we looked at it, and the sketch ran 17 minutes. Well, let's be practical about a four-hour show. A four-hour show, less the cost of the amount of time that that the network has to sell off to advertisers, less the amount of time that we are donating and... Did I say donating? Sounds like that, doesn't it? Okay. Less the amount of time that we are giving to the news and sports department to get in the great events of, you know, of the last 50 years. Gives us about 2 hours and 12, 15 minutes or so, 18 minutes at the most, of what we call material for the entertainment section of the show, be it drama, music, comedy, whatever. And to use 17 minutes of one sketch, well, I mean, it's an impossible situation. This has got to be, on the Monday morning after the show airs, the greatest second-guessing game in the history of the entertainment business, you know. For example, I'll tell you an interesting story. A couple of, 3 or 4 months ago, I took my wife to see a movie called That's Entertainment Part 2. And it was really a fun movie. And we saw the first one, and we liked that, and we watched the second one, and we walked out of the second one, and she turned to me, and she said, "Now, it's put on by MGM, as you probably know. It's all MGM." And she walked out. And my wife is not in this business. She just happens to be a sweet, nice Chicago girl who went to Senn High School and Northwestern and has been married to me for umpteen years, and I've known her since we're 14 years old. Okay? And actually, I was 14, and she says a few years younger. So she's not in this business. And we walked out of the theater, and she said, "Greg, I want to tell you," she said, I really like that picture, but I really feel that they certainly could have had something of Rita Hayworth." And I said, "Well, Ray Allen, dear, you don't understand that this is an MGM movie, and Rita Hayworth was with
Columbia,
right, was with Columbia." She said, "Well, I don't care. They still could have done it, you know." And I said, "Yes, dear." She said, I wanted to see Ginger Rogers. Now, why wasn't Ginger Rogers in this picture?" And I said, "Well, dear, Ginger Rogers was under contract to RKO in those days, and, you know, she could..." "Well, I see no reason why we couldn't see Ginger Rogers. I mean, certainly MGM could have gotten..." I said, "But, dear, this is a history of the movies of MGM." And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, my God." She said, "Do you realize what's going to happen after your show goes on the air?" She said, "Everyone's going to say, where's Arthur Godfrey? Where's Lucy? Where are all the people that were big hits that are on ABC and CBS through all the years? And you're going to have to, you know, make personal telephone calls to about 35 million people and saying, we're terribly sorry, but they were with another network." No, this is 50 years of NBC. Now, I must tell you, there are, for those of us, and I'm one, who are Lucy fans, there will be some moments of Lucy, but by and large, it's not going to be a big chunk of Lucy. There will be moments of Lucy working with Kate Smith, for example. Lucy working with Dean. Lucy working with a special that she did with Danny Kaye. But just moments. I mean, when I talk in terms of moments, maybe 12, 15 seconds, 18 seconds. In one case, this particular sketch maybe runs a minute and a half. But there will not be a sizable contribution of Lucy, because Lucy is essentially, you know, 98% of her professional career was done on CBS.
Well, they've got an anniversary coming up in a year or two,
then
they might call Greg Garrison.
Right, whatever. This is the year of the anniversary. As a matter of fact, it's interesting. The sketch that we're using, the front part of the sketch that we're using, her husband, who's, I think, producing the show, Gary Morton, called a couple of weeks ago, and he asked for permission to use the rest of that sketch on her own show. And it's interesting because I happen to direct that particular special that we're talking mm-hmm. about, you see. So we're using the first 30, 45 seconds of it, and he's using that plus the rest of the sketch on the Lucy special. At least that's what his plan was.
Sounds like a fantastic production coming up.
I think it
boggles
can be,
the mind.
That's it. That's really it. I think it's really going to boggle the mind. I think that we're attempting to get as much material and get as much of a representative account of everyone that we possibly can. Needless to say, every single solitary star and or performer that has appeared on the network, naturally, because of the space of time, mm-hmm. cannot be included. We hope to talk about some. We hope to see brief glimpses of them. But when you talk in terms of brief glimpses, we can include everyone. But it will look like it looked like one of the Nickelodeons that you saw when you turned the little lever and everything started to flick. And every flick would be another shot of somebody, and you can take just so much of that. I mean, I think you can take that for maybe a minute at a time, every 25 minutes or so. But you have to give people a chance to sit back and appreciate something that runs more than 10 seconds or 5 seconds or 30 seconds. There have to be some moments where you sit back. I mean, I think possibly the most difficult thing that we're doing is trying to narrow down the drama to a point where we can make some of the great moments really work. I mean, we have sat and looked at three or four different clips from Chayefsky's Marty, for example, which is the one that really sets off the piece, mm-hmm. which is the one that really makes Rod Steiger look best, which is the one that really gives us a flavor of the room, of the time, not the room, but of the time. And we have to take that all into consideration. We may not be picking the piece that Rod Steiger feels most comfortable with, or that Chayefsky feels most comfortable with. We are picking a piece that we feel sets up and sets off Marty in the time that we have allotted for Marty. Now, I must tell you, we're devoting about 2.5 minutes to a Marty sequence. Now, to maybe your listening audience right now, somebody would say, my God, man, are you kidding? 2.5 minutes to a classic? Well, all you have to do is just figure out the names of all the classics or all the great moments mm-hmm. that you mm-hmm. have seen and or listened to on the radio through the years, and you'd say, well, gee whiz. Well, play the game for a moment. Let your listening audience play the game. Just try three different approaches to it right now. List, if you would, the 10 greatest news stories of the last 50 years. What are the 10 great news stories of the last 50 years? Now, think about it just for a second. Oh, sure, you may come up with three or four that you really feel mm-hmm. are. Maybe Nixon. Maybe those of you who remember the dirigible fire of the Hindenburg. Maybe Lindbergh. What are the others? There are others. What are they? Think about it. If you're with someone, play the game. Put it down on a piece of paper. There's no way in the world that you're going to come out the same way. Do the same thing with the great sporting events of our time. What were they? What were the great sporting events in football, in basketball, hockey, tennis? Who was it? Was it Jimmy Connor? Was it Arthur Ashe? Was it those of us who may remember Bill Tilden? Who was it? Who were the fighters? Oh, sure, it's easy. The fighters are easy. Who? Joe Louis? Sure, Joe Louis. Who are the others? Jack Dempsey? Most of us don't even remember who Jack Dempsey was. But in his time, he was a great fighter. Was it Muhammad Ali? See, unfortunately, in the case of Muhammad Ali, those fights of Muhammad's, most of those fights, were on closed-circuit television, where they fed them to the theater mm-hmm. and they charged $10, $15. So the great classics were not broadcast because they couldn't afford to sell the rights for broadcasting. I mean, they put 18,000 people in, and in a Madison Square Garden or wherever, the Chicago Stadium. But, the $5, $7, $10, $12 million or whatever those gates were, they came from theaters and, closed circuit television. But there are a couple of fights of Muhammad Ali's that we're seeing on television. Television, let's talk about that just for an instant. What? Who are your favorite stars? Was it Jack Benny? Freddie Prinze? Dean? Who were they? Did you like George Gobel? Did you like Eddie Fisher? Go through it. Go through the list. Play the game. Just play the game and go through the first 10. Go through the first 12. Of all the sketches, of all the comedy shows, of all the great comedians, who were they? Certainly Sid deserves to be mentioned. Certainly Hope does. Hope more so than any man that ever lived on any network at any time spent 40 years of his life, professional life, being a superstar on radio and television. Superstar. Radio. Hope, along with, and to a certain degree, Dean, I must tell you, are one of the very few performers that made it in most of the mediums. And yet, as a nightclub performer, he never performed on a nightclub stage. Did you know that? Hope never, ever performed professionally on a nightclub stage, or Vegas, or any place else like that. On the other hand, Dean and Jerry, when they started, believe it or not, the tremendous success that started it all in nightclubs, they had a very successful radio show. And I remember once, many years ago, when I was working in Chicago, they came and they did their part of their radio show. I think they were working at the Shea Paree in Chicago in those days. And they did their radio show right from the Civic Opera House in Chicago. I think Sheldon Leonard was one of the straight men that they had. I remember seeing the show there. They were very successful in radio. And Dean is, you know, one of the few performers, along with Sinatra, who had tremendous success in every medium of the entertainment, the records, television, radio to a degree, I must say, and of course the records through the radio, television, nightclubs, and of course was a big, big picture star for a long time.
You've really whet our appetites with all the names and the possibilities, and I think we must circle Sunday, November 21st, on our calendar to have that dial set at NBC. It's part of a series of Sunday night events on the National Broadcasting Company television network now. I guess they call it the big event. And every Sunday night, something special. This has got to be the special event of the season.
This is going to be an event. I keep referring to it as an event of our time because it's the first time in history that any network has ever devoted 4 hours to one program in prime time ever, an entertainment program. Oh, sure, there have been telethons, but they have gone around the clock, you know. And they have, some of them have not been carried on a network basis, and certainly over the last few years they have not been. You know, they've been in regional areas. Gone with the Wind is a two-night, you know, program. It's the first night, I think, in November the 7th on a Sunday night. It's 3 hours. The second night, it's they finish up with 2 hours. And by the way, if you're going to watch...
This is all going to be in November. We're going to get to Gone with the Wind in the first 50 years.
And listen, I'm an old promoter from way back, and I can't resist. And when you're talking about Gone with the Wind, the second night of Gone with the Wind, when it's over, you got to stay tuned because Dean is doing his first variety special of the season. See? Gone with the Wind is over at 10, and we start at 10, and it's going to be called... It's kind of a fun thing. We're just putting it together now. It's called Dean Martin's Red Hot Scandals of 1926. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to shoot it on location all around the Los Angeles area. We're really sort of looking for old hotels that have, you know, that vintage kind of look. We could go to the Great Northern in Chicago. Didn't they have
that? No, you
could
not anymore.
Has that been turned
out? Yeah, it's gone but not forgotten.
Oh, is that really gone?
Yeah.
Didn't they put a school or something down there? Is Roosevelt College down in that area now?
Well, Roosevelt is still there at the Congress Expressway or the Eisenhower Expressway.
The Congress Hotel, I think that's what I was thinking of, the Congress Hotel, and some of those others that are in Chicago. Listen, I really, you know, thank you for the opportunity to, you know, to
well,
get to talk to your audience.
It's a pleasure for us to come out and talk to you and to not only to reminisce a little bit about the important contribution that you, Greg Garrison, have played in, or have made in the area of television and the good old days, but what you're doing today and especially what you're doing on this 50th anniversary of NBC. Appreciate that, too, very much.
Well, thank you. I hope everybody gets a chance to see it.
We wouldn't miss it. Thank you.
Thank you.